Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Wednesday, August 13, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Jim Flink and Ernest Perry. There's a lot we've got to talk about today, but I'm going to want to spend a real good chunk of the next half hour talking about a story that's gripped the attention of the nation, unfolding just about 100 miles to our east. It all started around noon on Saturday when a police officer came across two people, including 18-year-old Michael Brown, on a street near a Ferguson, Missouri apartment complex. Brown's friend, Dorian Johnson, describes what he saw at that time. Now, you're about to hear Johnson mention a he in this clip. The he that he's referring to is the police officer.
He pulled up on the side of us. He tried to thrust his door open, but we were so close to it that it ricocheted off us and it bounced back to him. And I guess that, you know, got him a little upset. And at that time, he reached out the window. He didn't get out the car. He just reached his arm out the window and grabbed my friend around his neck and was trying to, as he was trying to choke my friend, and he was trying to get away. And the officer then reached out and he grabbed his arm to pull him into the car. So now it's like the officer's pulling him inside the car and he's trying to pull away. And at no time, the officer said that he was going to do anything until he pulled out his weapon. His weapon was drawn, and he said, "I'll shoot you," or "I'm going to shoot." And in the same moment, the first shot went off. And we looked at him. He was shot, and it was blood coming from him. And we took off running.
Johnson says that he himself ducked and hid, but that Brown kept running, and the officer got out of the car.
His weapon was already drawn when he got out the car. He shot again, and once my friend felt that shot, he turned around, and he put his hands in the air. And he started to get down, but the officer still approached with his weapon drawn, and he fired several more shots.
Police offered a different account. Here is St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar.
And the officer had an encounter with two individuals, one of whom is Mr. Brown, who was walking down the road in Canfield Apartments. He spoke to the individuals about getting off of the street and perhaps taking the sidewalk. One of the individuals complied, the other did not. In fact, as the officer decided to get out of his car to continue the conversation, he was pushed back into the car, and there was a physical confrontation in that car where, in fact, there was a struggle over the officer's gun. We do know, for example, that there was one shot fired within the car. And then we're taking a look at the rest of the details of the investigation at this point to determine exactly what happened once the police officer exited the car.
Brown was killed in the street about 35 feet from the squad car, hit by more than one bullet. The FBI says it will be conducting its own investigation into what happened that day. Meanwhile, tensions in the community continue to escalate as residents demand answers. After a candlelight vigil Sunday night, violence erupted as crowds looted and vandalized stores and vehicles. Monday, it grew even worse as police unleashed tear gas and rubber bullets on the protesters and ended up restricting media access. There are probably close to about a dozen different aspects about this story that we can talk about, and we're going to spend a lot of time talking about as many of them as we can. But let's start by talking about how this original incident unfolded. I was actually out of state Saturday and got back late Sunday, and it was at about the time that happened. How did we see it come together in those first few hours?
Well, I think what you typically saw in the first few hours, and I have to admit that I was also, I got back in late mm-hmm. Saturday night, so I was reading about it and then watching the television newscast on it on Sunday. And I think what you saw initially was basically the way in which we cover all incidents like this. So a police officer has shot someone, what's the particulars about it? But I think this thing sort of grew very quickly, because of what you've seen with Trayvon Martin and several of the other shootings, into what you see right now. And I think that the one of the different takes that you see on this is the fact that the police and law enforcement have sort of said, we're going to be very careful about how we're going to release information, including the officer's name and any other pertinent information.
Which, as of the time we're recording this program, still has not been released.
Exactly, exactly. And then on the other side, what you're seeing is a full-out blitz in terms of the family and those supporters about the way in which they see it. Now, the offshoot of all of this is the violence that took place. And part of that is because you see some people taking opportunity to loot and destroy and do some other things. But I also think you see the frustration in the community about what happened. And that's where I think the media is having a difficult time in trying to provide news and information in a contextual way that people can really understand what's going on.
I can tell you that having been in a television newsroom in particular for 20 years, if you hear officer-involved shooting, that is in a newsroom, that is code for just about all hands on deck. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of coming across scanner traffic means you're going to deploy additional resources. Add to that, as Ernest mentioned, a very caustic, dynamic environment in which this happened, and immediately this is a flashpoint. This goes from being a story where there are all sorts of journalists that are on the ground, depending on the time of day that it happens, and as you go into the night, the dynamic changes. I've been talking with Ryan Schussler, a former student who's been on the ground covering it for Al Jazeera America. He's been there primarily during the day, but when you talk to reporters who cover this kind of an event during the day versus covering it at night, there are two very different kinds of dynamics that go, and it's almost Jekyll and Hyde. The escalation of emotion of the characters, the people who are involved in the activity, all that changes. And that's what's been happening in a 24/7 cycle now since this incident began, is that it is growing and it is receding, but not receding that much. But it is a very dynamic and very dangerous and changing circumstance.
And we're going to talk a little bit more later in the half hour about some of those issues that come in when safety comes into play with the differences between developments during the day and at night. Framing this story is really key. There are different ways this could be set up. And I want to ask you, how do you keep from having it become a sensational story?
That's the difficult part. I mean, when you have an officer-involved shooting, it automatically jumps to sensationalism. When you have an officer-involved shooting of an unarmed man, it grows even more.
And in this case, an unarmed teen, two days away from starting college.
2 days away from starting college. And he's an African-American. After all of the other incidents that we've had, race begins to play a huge role in this. Then you also bring in the dynamic of a police force that's majority white, that is supposed to be there and protect and serve a community that is majority African-American. It's very difficult for this not to become sensational. But one of the things that you can try to do is to provide some context to each and every story. And in today's visual media environment, it's very important to do that. And one of the things that I've seen throughout this coverage so far is a lack of context on the part of the visuals that are coming out of Ferguson, Missouri right now.
I totally agree with that. And I think, if anything, too many journalists aren't trying hard enough to walk the very line that you're talking about, Ernest. I mean, I think the problem in today's media-rich environment is that there becomes a question of judgment. There becomes a question of temperance. There becomes a question of when the situation is already sensational enough, as this one is, now you need to ratchet it back in order to do exactly what Ernest is talking about, which is to provide the very context that is needed in this situation to keep it from boiling over again and again. And in the coverage that I saw, I'm both encouraged and discouraged. There are so many voices that are weighing in on this, and I know we'll talk about this a little bit more, but you have professional journalists, you have people who should be professional who aren't acting very professionally as journalists, then you have all sorts of citizen journalists, you have all sorts of components here. That's a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing, because the wrong thing said on the wrong venue in the wrong way at the wrong time can then reignite the whole thing again.
And then the other part that especially everyone in the media who's covering this, and I'm talking about the professional media, needs to understand is that you have a lot of dynamics running throughout this, and you have a lot of individuals and groups involved, and they all have an agenda, and those agendas are competing. And as the media, as the professional media, we're supposed to sort of analyze that information and present it to the public in a way in which they can understand it, not in a way that sort of plays off of what one side of the agenda wants to have against the other.
Do you think one of the reasons we're not seeing that yet, maybe not getting that 30,000 foot view, is because it's all still happening so rapidly that no one's taken the time to put it into context yet? They're still so busy running after what's going on in the moment that maybe there hasn't been the time to think about that.
I think some of it is out there. I mean, you look at the Post-Dispatch coverage, and it is layered, and it is contextual, and you look at some of the television stations that are covering it, and you look at some of the national outlets. So I do think that there is some context. Some of the very things that Ernest mentioned in his opening comments about, the number of white police officers, these things all add context and understanding to the situation that at least help us to understand how did we get here, outside of the incident, which may be very incident specific, how did we get here? And so I think there is some of that. I do think that what you're saying about the fact that it continues to go on, those images continue to be the thing that rises to the top in terms of what's being consumed.
And I also think that, yes, you are starting to see those contextual stories, but the context and the words and the phrases that reporters are using, that's all well and good. It's the images and the visuals that they're using. Oftentimes, the visuals don't match the context that they're actually talking about. When you're actually talking about the disparity between the number of white officers as opposed to the population in Ferguson, but then the images that are coming across are of white officers pointing guns at black individuals, then you've got a disparity there.
Jim, I want you to talk for a second. I had seen that you had posted on social media today that you were somewhat disappointed in seeing the use of the word frenzy by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in a headline. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about why that word choice bothered you, as we're talking a little bit about some of that.
Well, because I think it's almost flippant to use that particular term. Frenzy, I think, in at least in my understanding of the word, and maybe in the way that I've used it in my own life, is one of those. First of all, it has multiple meanings, but second of all, I don't think that it goes to the core issue, and so it may be an issue. It's like clickbait, It's one of those things that I think grabs people's attention, but I don't think it's contextual at all. And so I think too often we are using words haphazardly, words that we don't necessarily think matter. And I think sometimes we're placing those in print, in headlines, and maybe it's to grab the attention of someone. But I thought that was a little bit irreverent of a term to use in describing this situation. A frenzy, I don't think it's apt.
Okay. Well, we also were talking a little bit ago about the differences of what's going on during the day and at night, how people are reacting, which begs the question, how does a newsroom keep its employees safe while covering this story? St. Louis Post-Dispatch photographer David Carson took a memorable photo of a man leaping from the looted Quick Trip gas station with an armload of wine bottles the other night. Carson says he heard someone say, "Get him, kick his ass," before he could run to safety. Someone hit him on the back of the head. Some TV crews retreated. Some of them ended up leaving voluntarily, others at the insistence of police. That left many citizens in the area claiming that the police were trying to cover up what was going on there and what their actions were. This is a lose-lose for the police department, isn't it?
It's a lose-lose for the police department, but it's also a lose-lose for the community in terms of them being able to find out what's going on, because the reporters who are out there trying to cover the story are becoming basically targets themselves. And I can tell you from being in a situation like that back in Los Angeles after the Rodney King verdict, that it is definitely dangerous for reporters who are out there trying to cover a riot situation. And I'm just going to be honest about it. The fact that I'm an African American actually not only helped me, but it also helped my photographer, who was white, in certain situations in which they were going after him, and I was able to basically stop them from hurting him. So in that respect, it is dangerous when reporters go out there and try to cover this. Now the police, they're trying to protect who they deem to be innocents, and in that case, it would be the photographers and the reporters, and they're trying to get them out of harm's way. So I think it's not fair to the police department to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we're going to charge you with trying to cover it up because you told the reporters to stay out. I think it's a double-edged sword there.
Very similar situation I had to what Ernest is talking about into this situation in Kansas City about 15, 20 years ago. Very similar dynamic. Being out, particularly in this situation at night, there are different elements that come into play. You know, during the day, and what's interesting about the Post-Dispatch headline that you showed is, you know, day of protest, night of frenzy. Okay, so we'll go with that. But the fact of the matter is there are two very different dynamics. At night, in our situation, when I was covering a riot that was very similar to this, police said, we're going to keep you here. We're going to keep you within these bounds. We want you to turn your lights off. We don't care if you're going live on television or not. Those lights will incite a certain element to become more agitated in this situation. And so we complied with that. You know, what's interesting about this is it's a fine line and it's a difficult line. Reporters don't want to cross police in this situation. They don't want to create new situations that they have to respond to. They don't want to agitate the situation, most of them. What I would say is police have a similar responsibility not to overstep their controlling interest bounds. Okay. Too many times officers want to be in charge of a crime scene when that isn't necessary. They want to assert their control over the situation. And I think what's happening in this situation is there is a disparity between officers who need to do their job on the street and those few officers who don't represent the whole who overstep that time and time again. And I think that is where the concern about controlling too much information and wanting to shut down the control of information enters in, and it's a very real concern with some officers.
But then I also think that we in the media also need to – we have some responsibility here. I think Jim brought up a good point we talked about where we need to – if we're going to do a live, we shouldn't have the lights on. If we're going to show something, we need to make sure we're showing it in context. And I'll give you a perfect example.
Yeah.
Last night I was watching KMIZ here in Columbia. They had a reporter there. He was doing a live. And he went on.
Was this Lucas Geisler?
Yes. He went on a little bit too long because being in that situation, all of a sudden, a certain element of the mass started heading in his direction. And instead of him saying, okay, we're going to cut this short, we're going to move on, he kept going. And they basically disrupted his entire live shot.
And you have to have an awareness about that as a reporter on the street. And this is the thing that in talking with Ryan Schuessler today, I said, sometimes you don't know how much trouble you're in until it's right on top of you. But when you know that you're in trouble, you need to know what you're going to do and you need to have your wits about. You need to have an awareness of what's going on and how what you're doing is impacting that.
Right. Well, because you become a part of the story.
Indeed.
And he actually became a part of the story toward the end.
By being caught up in it. Well, maybe as a result of some of these safety concerns, we're seeing a lot of the imagery that's coming out of these scenes from citizen journalists republished from social media. Newsrooms use tools like Storify to curate Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram posts into a single page. One of those prolific posters we see appearing again and again is Antonio French. He's a former blogger who's also now the 21st Ward Alderman for the city of St. Louis. And for the past 72 hours, his Twitter feed has been the one to watch. The kind of access we're seeing here through just bystanders' mobile devices, that's where the really powerful stuff is coming from.
Well, and you said the right word, access. I mean, the thing that's happening with Antonio French is that he's having access where professional journalists don't dare go or where they're not allowed to go. And so he is bringing a part of the story that no one else is sharing. Now, I will say this because I spent a good deal of time on his Twitter feed today. You know, I mean, I think the great thing about this is – more voices really being heard and resonating in the marketplace and adding value to the conversation and context. The negative side sometimes is the very thing that we talked about earlier, which is that journalistic sort of season sort of idea of, okay, what do I include here? What don't I include here? Not that it doesn't all have value, but that I think sometimes you have to say, am I being played here? Am I being utilized here in a way that is irresponsible? And I saw a couple of elements there where I thought, well, I would like more context here. I would like to know if this person is really telling me the straight scoop.
Yeah, and part of it is that when you have that sort of element in there, and I've taken a look at this page as well, you have an agenda, and you're setting a tone. And that tone,
he has a political agenda as much as anything else as a member of the city council,
even if
not in Ferguson, in St. Louis, mm-hmm. which is still St. Louis County.
Yes, he does. Now, I would give him credit that he has been upfront about where his agenda lies and what he's trying to do. But someone who's coming into it from outside of the area may not necessarily pick up on that and may not completely understand this is what's happening here. But he's not the only one. There are others out there that are doing the same thing. So, you know, you've got to be savvy in understanding what's happening here, especially when you're talking about social media. And I'm not sure that the public is quite there yet in terms of media literacy or news literacy and understanding what's news that's put in a contextual format that gives you about as clear a picture as possible, or what's an agenda type of media environment.
Well, I was trying to do a lot of research on Mr. French myself, because in several places he's referred to as a former journalist and now 21st Ward Alderman for the city of St. Louis. I kept trying to figure out for whom he worked.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't any record of a professional news organization. It's always been as former blogger. And today's not the day for us to have the debate of are bloggers journalists. That could be another whole show in and of itself. But that context and that filtering that comes through is a trained journalist who's had to adhere to ethical codes that we have, say, through the Society of Professional Journalists, that we teach here through the Journalist's Creed, it does bring some of that into question.
I think it does.
I think it does. But you also have to remember that when you're talking about a situation like this, he comes at it from a perspective that a lot of journalists don't have.
Mm-hmm.
He brings himself into it. And I'm okay with that as long as he's upfront about it and he talks about it continuously so that the audience knows that. Because I think one of the things that really hinders us as journalists is that we aren't upfront about our own biases, mm-hmm. and tendencies in our stories. And then we are, quite often, we're chastised for it because we don't do it.
So another aspect that's come as a result of all of this use of images from social media, it's become quite common, although it's sometimes as illegal from a rights issue, that television stations and online news sites have gotten into the habit of publishing photos on the air, sometimes with credit, sometimes without, that they find on Twitter, on Instagram, in breaking news situations. And there have been some complaints, specifically from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, that they're getting phone calls from the different television networks looking to use some of these, for lack of a better word, iconic photos that have come out of this without being willing to pay for them, that they'd like them as a professional courtesy. Where and when do you offer that as a professional courtesy, and when is it something that the paper should expect to get some kind of compensation for?
Well, I'm not so sure about the compensation part. I mean, this is something that's been done over and over. I mean, if you're a member of the Associated Press, then
you put it on the wire.
You put it on the wire, and the photo is out there. And news organizations, television news organizations, have used each other's tapes for years. So I don't get the whole compensation part of it. And in a story like this that has national resonance, then you're gonna see that kind of thing. But what bothers me is the images that they choose to use. And they use those images without context. And it doesn't really give a full picture of what's going on. And this is what the public is seeing. So, and this is what they're determining whether or not they're going to believe one side of the story, the other side of the story, they're just going to be confused.
So I think a photo shows up on a screen, maybe without a caption, that would accompany it online or in print, and then there's no real way to put that into its place.
Yeah, and just real quickly, complicating that is that the newspapers are now competing with the television stations in the video space, and to some extent vice versa. And so it used to be that a television station would call the newspaper in advance and say, hey, is there something that we can share here, and each had value to offer. Now, where the lines are melding, and both staffs have video partners, and they have, you know, folks that are focusing on the same kinds of things. Now they're competitors. Now it feels a little bit more like steel and a little bit less like cooperating, and that has to be worked through, usually in advance, should be, instead of in the spur of the moment.
Very good point there. There's another aspect of this story that's playing out on social media. Another case of hashtag activism. That's a result of these two photos. They're both Michael Brown. On the left, Brown is wearing baggy clothes with his hands showing, his fingers spread apart. On the right, a close-up shot of a smiling face with headphones on. That's led thousands of black men to tweet similar photos of themselves to the hashtag #IfTheyGunnedMeDown, showing how different they look in different situations, different settings, etc. The contrast is obvious. Men drinking or smoking next to photos of themselves teaching or delivering political speeches or playing with their kids. We've talked about hashtag activism in the past. Specifically, the one first thing that came to mind for me was the Bring Back Our Girls. Mm-hmm. This is very different. This is our audiences coming back to us with some legitimate media criticism.
I think this one is different in terms of the fact that they're actually going after the media. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem that I think has been going on is that the media will jump on someone's Facebook page and they'll pull the whatever they see off of there that fits the narrative they have in their heads, instead of trying to find out who is this person? Who
is Michael Brown? Which is going back to the framing we talked about before.
Exactly.
And it's a discussion that needs to happen, because right now what's happening is there is a growing gulf of understanding that's happening in this country, despite the fact there are more voices and there is more discussion. It seems to be more polarized than ever. This kind of discussion really helps boil it down to a very simple thing. Take a look at these two photos of the very same person and tell me that you know, looking at one or the other or both, more about this individual. It's a discussion that we need to have.
And it boils down to one of the things I tell my students all the time. It's not about you. The story is about the person, and you need to find out about that person and which one of those photos actually matches him and his story and his life and his lived experience, as opposed to what you think it should be based on stereotypes and information that you don't have.
And on that point, there's an article that's on our Links blog written by Kyra Kyles that was published on Tuesday in Jet, saying that maybe before we do, like, to build on that conversation, that we should be looking at who the person is as a whole, that we don't necessarily need to glorify everybody in death. Just because a family member has a certain perception of someone doesn't necessarily mean that is always the case. At the same time, she couched that argument by saying, let's not have more people be shot down, gunned down, and die to be able to prove whether or not the theory holds true.
What this does, unfortunately, is it tries to justify two very simplistic talking points. Either you are this person or you are that person, right, when we are all, in fact, very complex
people. It takes the complexity out of the story.
Thank you very much.
One of the things that needs to be in there.
But what happens is taking the complexity out makes it easier to have these very polarized talking points. And that is a lack of reason, a lack of understanding, and a lack of seeking of the truth.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time for today's program. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. There's a lot more that we were hoping we'd be able to talk about today, including the untimely death of actor-comedian Robin Williams and issues related to diversity in American newsrooms. But we're going to go ahead and keep the conversation going online. You'll be able to find those segments throughout the week on our website. Check out the talk show tab at kbia.org. They'll also be on our YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/views of the news. You can also like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Hope Kerwin is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.